Hello, everyone. Quick programming note. After a year break from the podcast, we're returning with new episodes from founders building businesses outside of Silicon Valley. This episode with Dan Rockwell was recorded 1 year ago, and I think you'll enjoy it. Dan is a great friend and a strong advocate for startups in Columbus, Ohio. Enjoy. World, and welcome to the Flyover Startups podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Poehler. Each episode, we talk to founders who are building their businesses outside of Silicon Valley in the so-called flyover states. For this episode, I'm joined by Dan Rockwell of Big Kitty Labs. He also heads up program acceleration at OSU. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I've been wanting to get you on the podcast for a while now because, I think when I started at, just getting into the startup scene, you were already sort of a well-known figure. So let's just get started on, where did you grow up?
Wow, where did I grow up? I grew up here in Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. I'm the youngest of six.
Oh, wow.
I know, there's six of us. and my father was a professor at Ohio State, so I'm the son of a professor. So kind of fell into all this stuff. Didn't really plan for it. I guess kids today, when they grow up, they say, "Dad, I'm going to be a startup." And I don't know.
Well, how did you fall into it?
I fell into it through, I was working for my brother, who's got a company called Lexton downtown. Mm-hmm. Ohio. It's a design research company. And I was working for him doing, kind of a mixture of sort of special rigs. I was sort of designing user experience research tools. I basically observe the researchers while they're trying to do their task, whether through interviews or using specialty cameras or whatnot. And I would I'd continually improve on what they were trying to do. Everything from transcript analysis to build a better camera rig to grab a unique situation where they had to understand what a user was doing. And I've been following the startup space mostly because I was, I've always been into web technology and always been interested in computers. Obviously, I've been sort of the kid in the family that's just always on this fringe space. And startups sort of existed on the fringe before they kind of became mainstream, I think. And it was in 2008 that I went to the first startup weekend that came to Columbus. By then, Startup Weekend, I think it started 2005 or 2006 or whatnot. And I came to that first Startup Weekend, and I had a Moleskine notebook. I've always been consumed with these Moleskine notebooks I have. And I had like 20 ideas on that thing. I was like, I'm going to pitch one of these ideas. I had like three ideas that I pitched, and the one I pitched was basically building a better front-end user experience interface for Mechanical Turk, which I was obsessed with at the time. I'd been spending a lot of time at Mechanical Turk doing weird experiments and basically testing the limits of crowdsourcing, I guess, in some ways, on that platform before crowdsourcing really hit mainstream again. It was at that event that I kind of, Startup Weekend, it's a pretty set formula. You meet brand new people kind of come together, and that's where I met my partner at Big Kitty Labs, Tashar, and our first company that we sort of put together that weekend was this thing called Spotwork, which later turned into Geometric. And I remember on Sunday they gave me $50,000. They're like, "Hey, you won." And I was like, wow, what do you mean we won? I mean, like, I just met these people. I don't know who they are. And they're like, "No, we liked your pitch the best." And the thing is, we didn't actually build anything. Startup Weekends now are pretty centered on you actually coding and everything. Instead, we actually used Mechanical Turk and did a bunch of research and then showed that research in a weekend. And People were sort of impressed with the ability for us to get all these answers and sort of articulate. We just articulated a really great idea.
Well, yeah.
And I just remember them getting, saying, "Here's your $50,000 and And of course, it wasn't really like 50 grand. It was like you have the opportunity to get 50 grand if you write this and you do this, jump through this hoop, that kind of thing. It's never clear like that. No one ever hands out cash.
And we'll get 20% of that. And
it was through that event that I learned a lot and failed a ton. And then I learned a lot of things that I didn't like about the whole space. And then that led to the formation of Big Kitty. And then, Big Kitty was a Skunk Works, project for basically me and Tashar to pursue our own sort of ideas. In some ways, he let me pursue a ton of my own ideas. And then from there, we just happened to get work from people because people were like, wow, you sort of have this no excuses attitude toward making things. I'd like to use you for development. And so, and we lucked out by getting really affordable development overseas, and we had to actually work toward that too. We also use the outsourcing. That's a key piece of Big Kitty that I think is comes with a double edged sword in this space. Either people really love it or they really hate it. There's not really a nice gray zone there, but I think that's the thing that people probably don't really understand about me so much is that I'm not a developer. I'm an orchestrator. I think that's why I tend to put myself down as a master of orchestration. I know enough of the technology and enough of what could be possible, and then it's really about articulating that experience to a developer that you can use, and then building that vision and making sure that everyone's on board with what you're trying to do.
Sure. So let's back up for a second. I know sort of that first year with Geometric. You've told me this story before, but if you don't mind sort of going through the sort of the failure mode of that first company and how that sort of shaped your thinking for Big Kitty, and especially how it led to the concept of proto-baking, which is now like kind of lean startup, but I think it's a cooler name.
Thanks. Well, yeah, so with Geometric, We did everything that was like, I felt like, when you start a company in any state, this really could happen in any city. You get like the packet from the city, whoever's in charge of economic development says you should do the following. So one of the first big, I think, mistakes that we made at Big Kitty was a high price lawyer that we were initially hooked up with. Okay. And I think that was a result of just not knowing. We don't know. And that's one of the big problems with startups is that you're working with, you're devoid of data. You really have no idea. So you plow through everything, learning as you go. Mm-hmm. And so we spent like 15 grand on a Porter Wright lawyer at the time, which is, I thought was crazy. And this year we had 10 founders. That was another problem, right? So it's like,
that's a lot of dilution.
Funny, a lot of them are folks I know in Columbus. Nick Seguin with Dynamit was part of that original crew. It was funny. Even Bobby was part of that original crew, and they all sort of bounced way early on, like Sunday. They were like, we're not really doing this. By then, Nick had already done a lot of startup weekends, and he was actually just looking at getting that job at Kauffman at the time. I felt like we played house. We played business house. Like we got the office and we formalized the documents and we did the stock shares and we kind of got away from what the actual product was. And we talked about the product and I think my general frustration was just speed and user experience. And I wanted to build something. I just wanted to go. I didn't want it to be perfect. I wanted it to go. Yeah. And so it really was just, I bounced and I had a really, really terrible taste in my mouth of the whole thing. And I started, this notion, this thing called Big Kitty Labs as a sort of really an FU to the whole scene. No, it wasn't like I'm going to go and do my own startup. It was like, no.
That was your punk rock phase.
Yeah, it was like my punk rock, like flipping the bird to the whole thing. I didn't like the notion. I didn't like the notion I needed 80 grand to build something or 100 grand to realize it. I just felt like that was crazy. And luckily, Tashar, he's kind of like the quiet Indian guy in the room who's really excited about building things. He's very generous. Tashar was amazing. Tashar paid for so many things early on at Joe Metric that we just didn't really. Yeah, he paid for our first round of business cards. He paid for our first round of, go out to food or any promotional stuff. He picked all that up. And he would do it. He wouldn't tell you about it half the time. You'd have to say, like, what did you do? You're like, oh, I paid for that. We're like, why? Stop that, you know? it was just super generous. And he told me about, he was working on a soccer site for this Indian soccer site. And I was like, well, let me look at it. So I looked at it and I said, well, hey, we should fix this and let's do the user comments this way. And we basically helped him do the UX side on that. And then he launched that site with a friend. And then he came back to me. He's like, hey, let's do something again. And yeah, he's like, I'm going to do this thing called Big Kitty. And he's like, sweet, let's do it. Yeah, what do you want to work on? So we just, we locked together and we're like, bam, we'll do this. And, you know, he's really the principal quarterback of Big Kitty that, I think I'm the front man. You know, I may be the singer of Big Kitty, but Tashar does 98% of what Big Kitty is, really. And I think and we make a good team like that.
Yeah. So Big Kitty provides that sort of for your clients, which are mostly startups. They provide that initial, hey, let's go through this first few rounds to validate the idea.
Yep.
To get that juicy data.
Yep.
Sort of get you started on the path.
Yeah, I think it started with the notion of getting the data, but it's about getting belief going so people can stay engaged, you know, and it's not about building the final product. It's about, let's just build this thing in slices. Or a lot of times it's discovery work. Let's go and test, you know, your initial theory on how you think someone would use the following things before you really, you know, blow a ton of money on it. And that's always tough. You know, it's one thing that kills me every time I talk to somebody about a concept. It's always like, well, how much would it cost? I'm like, well, it really depends. And
yeah,
no one likes that, you know, no one likes that. They're like, no, just give me the final number. Okay, it's a 20 grand. I'll lock it in my brain. I'm like, lock any number in your brain, lock 100 grand and let's start at making it for five. You know, it's like, you know what I mean? Cause it could, because a lot of times they're just experimenting with ideas that are not sticky yet, and startups are just completely unrealistic, I think, when people are trying out. And they're not even startups yet. I mean, they're really projects. They're completely unrealistic about their burn.
From a development perspective, you know, if you're working on a, you know, for a startup company, it's like, well, you know, this is experimental. You're building something, like an experimental aircraft, you know, there's no blueprint.
Yeah. It's also like you're flying to an island where you think people are going to exist. And you're like, you know,
yeah.
No one's actually going to be on that island.
Right.
Damn, we didn't actually need a plane. We need a boat. You're like, oh man, here we go. So, I mean, and that's the thing that, funny thing is I had to learn that the hard way with Big Kitty. I had to learn the way to really push back on gigs and turn down gigs just because they were like the logic that was surrounding them was really kind of crazy or flawed.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do when you're hungry, you know, when you're hungry and you're trying to, you know, keep the cash in the bank. Cause that's where we came up with the sort of four-way grid, the horizontal line, the vertical line. The horizontal line is, our relationship with customers sort of can either be, we can be partners or people want us to basically be their bitch. And then the vertical line coming through the stack is ideas can be really vague or they can be exact. And the first quadrant is really where the customer or the client can be kind of a partner, but the idea is really vague. And we call this discovery. And this is, this is like the sub 20K zone. This is usually first time entrepreneurs. This can be a lot of discovery work for, you know, 5-10K. It's a space that can be kind of crazy, but it's also kind of like it's open and exploratory. And then the space below that between partners and the idea is more exact. This is, you still have a coachable, mentoring, you know, advisable client, but they know more. They actually kind of do have a plan for what they want. They have some designs, they have some things. The quadrant where the idea is exact and the clients can be a bitch, and I don't mean to say that bad on your show, but they can be troublesome or painful. That's what I call mercenary work, where the person knows exactly what they want and they're pretty adamant about it. And they don't really want you to think too much. And those sometimes can be gigs that are actually very promising in terms of profitability, because you're just like, you're a hired gun.
Right.
And you don't have to think too much. But at the same time, you're hoping that they're, you know, whatever, you're building a, you know, jet propelled, you know, sleigh, you know, okay, all right, we'll put that thing together. It'll go 6,000 miles per hour. And, you know, you know, and you kind of walk from it. It's not always rewarding work, but I guess that's one of the things that through Kitty, we had to kind of learn what was rewarding and what wasn't, you know?
So what quadrants do you like working in the best?
I prefer to work in the discovery and the partnership sort of quadrants, which is all on the obviously on the partnership space. I like those, but the mercenary work I don't mind. We've done a lot of mercenary work, and they tend to be pretty profitable gigs for us, but they're not gigs that are really rewarding. You know, I think all sort of consulting kind of comes down to you got to find a way to separate yourself a little bit from the actual gig so that you don't get consumed into it and start
caring more than the actual than the person who hired you.
It happens a lot. And Tashar and I always kind of end up back on the same page. We're like, gosh, we got to find a way to do something else, you know? So that's why we build our own things for fun too. So, and then there's a piece of work that I have in there that's sort of right in the center called surgical. Whereas like, for example, we had, you meet somebody who's a very large player or has a pretty established piece of infrastructure and whatnot, and is interested in working with you, but you're not really sure about working with them, and you don't really know if your approaches or ideologies will really mesh well. So rather than signing on for a, you know, 50,000 gig or whatever, and basically saying we're going to be best friends for life, I usually say let's do a very small piece of work together and find out if we're a fit first before we go and get married. And that's actually worked out really well. And sometimes it's helped us go like, wow, we're not a fit at all. You know, it's like regret or we're like, hey, yeah, we do that. We can fit, you know.
I guess with all the projects you mentioned, you like to open source the development of it, and you kind of act as a facilitator. And I mean, early on, like how difficult was it to sort of find an offshore team that you could work with? And was it just something that you just had to go through a few projects and go through that pain until you found?
Yeah, we did. It was really pretty crazy. When I look back on those years, it seems like a year and a half where we went through like 9 developers.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, started. And so I started, so we put together like a test. It's basically like we tried to find things that were relatively had a mix of user experience and a mix of technical sort of challenge to it, and like these, and it was mostly other startups. Like go rip off this site, and that's kind of what the task was.
Oh wow!
And it was about like, you know, we tried to give them some vague information, but we wanted to see if they could pick up, like sort of get the sense of what we wanted, and with little to no information, see what they could put together. That was the goal, because not always are we going to have a ton of information. Most of the time, we're gonna tell them exactly what they need and give them the design. What we really wanted to see is how these developers would work when the information sucked, because that's when, you know, that's when things can really go out of hand. And we tried a guy in Australia. We tried a guy in the UK. We ended up with we had this one great team in Brazil. Man, Brazil has like a lot of great coders, and there was like, it was like a whole company. It was like a, like 30 guys, and they would, you know, contact us and like, we're really excited about building that app. I was like, whoa, this is like, you know, this is only like a 5K gig, man. I don't want like your whole, you know, it just seemed crazy to have 20 people be like, let's wake up in the morning and we're all gonna work for Dan. I'm like, whoa, you know, it seemed intense, you know. But they were excited. They wanted to do everything. They wanted to package graphics, had a sound guy, a composer.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was like full-fledged, you know, stuff. And it was still, you know, decent rate. We did do an app with them later on. But we ended up really using this guy that we got in Ukraine. And he lives in a city that I can't even pronounce. It's like the city is like, literally, Pat, it's like 70 characters long. It's like this massive city name. And he's a young student who just got out of college, and he was going to take a job in London as a bank. He speaks French and Russian, and he was going to go work for this bank. And he was doing freelance work online, and he like totally nailed the assignment that we kind of gave him. And we're like, wow, okay, so let's throw him some work. And we've been using him ever since. It's been pretty awesome. He's kind of an extension of Big Kitty. His name's Andre Finier, and he's awesome. He's really the other third member of Big Kitty that we don't really talk about that much, but he's the nuts and bolts behind everything.
Oh, very cool.
His background is big on analytics and math, so he does.
Oh, so that fits your mission exactly.
Yeah, totally. So when I tell him like, hey, I want to build a natural language, search engine, or I want to build some transcript analysis, and he's like, oh, that's cool, let's build that, So he loves that.
So how many Big Kitty clients have gone on to, raise additional rounds? Like, have you had any, so far, any, sort of proud moments, I guess?
Yeah. Well, we were sort of the early discovery and building team for a company called Quilt, which is out in San Francisco. I think they've gone on to raise between $1 to $5 million, I think. They're basically creating like a Facebook clone, or it's really kind of based on this notion of Quilt. I create a quilt and share. It's almost like a Path competitor. When Path came out, Path sort of created a whole new subgenre of social networks that people wanted to be more close and more personal and less how Facebook was sort of created. So Quilt is in that space. I don't know if they're still doing that. We were the engineering team initially behind the Cincinnati startup Leap.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So Leap came out of the Brandery. That was originally a wellness platform that they were sort of aimed at insurance companies, and then they sort of pivoted into Leap, which was a mobile application where you sort of challenge your friends to do stuff. They had a really great design, and we just jumped on board and did all the engineering there initially. And that was a fun project because we did that. We're part of a big startup that's going on in New Jersey right now called Practice Unite, called Navio Health, which is a healthcare medical sort of mobile health play. And they're probably raising between $1 and $5 million at the moment right now. That's all. That was our experience last year building a HIPAA compliant mobile application, which was pretty insane. That was really pretty crazy.
That almost sounds like a contradiction in terms. Mobile is kind of insecure by almost definition.
There's a lot of times we're like an incremental player, and then people go on. And so that's one of the places that's a little hard for Big Kitty, and I think people probably hard to realize too, is that we help people get started, but we're not going to be the last technology platform they use. In some ways, I tell people, look, you're going to spend $10K on me, and I'm going to get you going, and then you're going to spend the $50K and rebuild again. But you got that $50K because the $10K helped you get it.
And so is that a hard thing for some clients to accept too? That the code might be just thrown away at the end of it.
Yeah, it is. I think a lot of folks don't like that idea at all. They're like, whoa, I want to keep everything I've got here. I'm like, no, actually you don't in some ways. I think there's this notion of like, I don't want to spend money and just lose it. I'm like, well, then you're in the wrong field, man. I don't think I would ever, I would never think that completely. What was interesting, though, is that a lot of times when the client would get that and they would understand, they're like, oh, yeah, once I raise my 100 grand, I'm going to hire my own development team, right? Yeah, and do all your own stuff. Cool. What's funny is they still end up using your initial infrastructure to get them going.
Let's transition into your work at Ohio State.
Yeah.
It sounds very, from what I know, it sounds very familiar to, it's almost a natural extension off of Big Kitty. But if you could explain to our listeners what you do for Ohio State and some of the programs you lead.
Sure.
There.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. It is kind of a natural extension to Big Kitty. So at Ohio State, I was basically lured there by Brian Cummings, who came to town. So Ohio State, if you look at the Central Ohio technology scene, for the longest time, we've known about things like Tech Columbus as being a central incubator for technologies or ideas for people putting things together. But the university didn't really play a space in that, or at least not something that we would normally ever hear about. And I think they've always had this technology transfer office. Now, technology transfer offices, every university has one, and they're basically the group that looks over all the intellectual property that the university produces and helps create licenses and bring royalties back in, basically helps take their ideas to market. And it's typically a license deal. When I say license, it's like you come up with a great new, you know, chemical compound. We take this chemical compound, we talk to Exxon. Exxon gives us an XYZ dollar for it, and we give it to them, and we get a royalty check. And that's how that industry kind of works, or easily 88% of it's based on that, it seems like. And in the last 5 years or 4 years or so, I guess Ohio State has tried to really rejuvenize their commercialization efforts and get more for their intellectual property. Traditionally, they don't get that much, you know. And of course, there's the classic phrase for commercialization at Ohio State is, you know, the university spends $860 million a year in research and they commercialize about a million of it. So there's a question like, whoa, we're not doing enough. Well, yes and no. I don't think it's ever been a complete, you know, center focus for them, and I think it's a I've learned a lot about commercialization in some ways. But so I came to the university, and basically I'm running their software prototyping center. So this is a center that when I met Brian, he's like, well, what would you do if you came to Ohio State? We're going to redo this thing. And I was like, well, if you're going to do it, you should do this. And I literally wrote down in a sketchbook, like, some notes. I gave it a name, and I told him what I would want to do. And I even talked to people in town about it. You know, I talked to, you know, friends I knew, like, you know, Nick Seguin or Brian Zerker and some other folks. And, you know, they're just like, yeah, that's pretty cool. That would be great. And I gave that to them. And they were like, sweet, when do you start? I was like, wow, that was pretty insane. So I basically, any piece of IP that comes out of the university that gets disclosed to our office, that's keys. Not everything gets disclosed to our office. But they're obviously encouraged to, because the university owns all the IP. So it's just a matter of, you know, if we find it, we can get it disclosed. Or if you disclose it to us, we'll see it. And I basically oversee all software in the sense of, I look at software and I say, okay, what stage is it in? Is it really, really, truly marketable? Is there a big idea behind this? Can we get this to market? If so, what do we need to do? Is it a direct license with a company like Exxon? And we just had to tell a better story around it, or can we, you know, turn it into a startup and so forth? And obviously startups, I think the whole thing with licensing, I think licensing is great, can make the university money, which it cares about. But yeah, licensing just to larger corporations doesn't create an ecosystem.
Right.
So it's the startups that create an ecosystem. If you can create them in Columbus, you don't have to create them in Columbus, you can create them anywhere. But obviously if you can create them in Columbus and you can drive the whole space, you know, you drive the noise, you can drive the energy, you can drive the hopes and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of, you know, feel good aspects around startups. Of course, it's also super hard, and it's, you know, everyone's going to get judged by the market in the end, no matter how much, you know, we all are super happy and doing, you know, singing Kumbaya, like the market's going to crush us the minute we go outside. So, you know, it's a little tough, but, so I'm that's my role at TCO, is to kind of to beat that startup drum for one, and then of course all software is kind of in my wheelhouse. And there's other people there too that do software, and I tend to be on any software gig as, you know, another voice, I guess. And then I do things like Wake Up Startup, which is a pitch event. We just mostly organize. That's a group that's sort of created through Brian Link and Derek Seif and Mike Figuillo and Brian Zerker and Brian Cummings and myself.
Wake Up Startup has grown. I mean, it's going on its second year, I think.
Yeah, we're on our second year.
Yeah, I remember the first one still. I don't know. I think maybe there were like 30 or 40 people.
Yeah, 30
in the room, and people. And now you bring in like close to 100.
Yeah, it's about 100 every time. It's funny, you don't really have to advertise it that much anymore. You know, we set up the Eventbrite, but, you know, sometimes you'll get 20 people signed up at Eventbrite, and then, you know, 100 people show up that day. So it's like, yeah, people just find out about it. And of course, I think that's been a great event for Ohio State to sort of, you know, galvanize its mission, which is like, hey, we're serious about economic development. We're serious about, you know, trying to get people to go off and do things. It's a great showcase for the OSU faculty members that are trying to kick off technology. It's this great reality call. You know, whenever so many people are like, I have this great idea for this thing, I think this should be a no-brainer. I'm like, okay, well, go and stand for 5 minutes and tell 100 people about it. It's not to say that those 100 people are your final judges, but it helps open that window of, wow, I don't know if I really know what I'm talking about, or, you know, part of it's a confidence game, getting up there and talking about it. And, of course, it's a nice open mic session for other startups in town as well. And I think that's helped create this sort of new speaker sort of series movement that you see. It's happening in Central Ohio, or Columbus at least, where you have things like Wake Up Startup and Sundown Rundown. And I just read about Motivate, which is another one. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Oh, I'm not familiar with Motivate. I don't think I've seen that.
Kind of a DIY version of it. It's less of startups. It's more focused on showcasing people with sort of DIY talents that they can share.
Very cool.
Yeah, the Meadery or whatever puts that thing together. So it's free. I think it's cool. And of course, there's TEDx in town and Ignite and Pachacucha, you know. So I think it's cool to have all these things kind of come together.
Has the startup landscape here in Columbus, as it has with anywhere, has changed? I remember, I guess about 3 years ago, there really wasn't a massive gathering or really a lot of places to go outside of Startup Weekend where, you know, startup founders can congregate. Have you seen that change in the past 3 years, for the better? And yeah. Do we have a long way to go, I guess, before,
I feel like there's still a long way to go. I know that, like Mission Coffee has become sort of ground zero for a lot of folks in town. Mm-hmm. There in the Short North. I definitely see a lot of startup new folks kind of talk about. I think people are looking for the hangout, you know, like where can people go and find other startups. I think the Mission Coffee has definitely been one of those places. Definitely in the last, 9 months, it's been sort of a premier place. And Thursday mornings, they're sure to do the Venture Cafe folks, which is another group too. And I think Stoffs is another sort of hangout. And of course, Tech Columbus is really trying to retool itself and rebrand itself pretty vigorously just towards startups. Now, whether or not they still have a long way to go, because I don't think people think about, want to go and hang out.
It's just not in a metal warehouse.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people talk about like the deck in Dublin that got rejuvenized. It's over here. It's actually really close to my house now, which is nice. Over here on France Road. But that's still very, you come in and hang out in cubicles. It's funny. I've had lots of talks with David Chisborough, who was a CEO of Cosi. Cosi is trying to kind of get into this space a little bit. They're trying to create it's not really targeting startups. They're more interested in the broad, strokes of innovation in general, which is kind of like maker movement / the electronics movement, like the Arduino stuff, and then startups are in that space and co-working and that kind of stuff. So I think they're going to get play a hand in that. I think the 400 West in Columbus is really huge. It's really starting to kind of gain some steam. The Steam Factory from Ohio State, that's a sort of a close-knit, that's kind of a steampunk technology group of faculty and staff members who are putting together ideas and stuff. And the university is starting to definitely get more interested in these spaces. They're together in pockets and groups. But I still feel like there's not there's always room for more. And I know there's a lot of times people, I always get conflicted sort of opinions on that. A lot of people are like, oh, it's too noisy. There's too many people who are still saying, this is the way it should be. There should be one voice. And I'm like, it never works, man. It never works to have one voice. I'd rather have it be, 90 voices in town versus one. It just doesn't work that way.
I think the multitude of voices is better. And from what I've seen, especially with like Mission Coffee and just sort of, just founders are getting together, on their own and, mm-hmm. you know, it's like we're not in true entrepreneur fashion, you know, you're not seeking permission from another organization or something just to meet somewhere. So, I just think though that entrepreneurship is it appeals to a very small select number of people.
And that, you know, I mean, what was interesting about that, for example, was, you know, the computer science department at Ohio State put together this two events happened this year that I thought was interesting. One was the computer science department put together a hackathon, and they packed it with like 120 kids that came in, and almost none of them could care less about startups. None of them really cared about entrepreneurship. They just came in there to hack. And so in some ways the whole voice of entrepreneurship and startups appeals to a very, like, I agree. I think it appeals to a very set type person who's thinking in that space. But there's also a whole other group of crafters and makers that don't even put them in that same space.
Yeah.
and it's kind of crazy at times. The other one I saw was the Ohio Game Developer Expo that Chris Volpe and a couple of other folks here in Columbus put together. And it's really just, you know, aimed at these game developer folks here in town. And they packed it. They packed it with like freaking, I don't know, 250 people. It was in the Ohio Union. And it was just off the hook sort of production-wise. You know, they had speakers and they had panels and all these things. And they had a huge vendor showcase room. It was kind of the event I wish a startup weekend would sort of do, which is you had a vendor room showing off all the different people who were trying to build things. And the one thing that I thought was amazing about Pat, I think it would be really cool if you were there, was that all the talks were the same in terms of like what you hear at a typical startup weekend or a startup conference. They were like how to get your ideas going, stay fresh, how to, you know, make things and develop things, how to monetize things. I was like, gee, this is a startup conference. It's just for name, you know? And I was, you know, on this panel, I was on this creativity panel. I thought, oh, this is interesting. I'm on the creativity panel, but we're having the same freaking conversation about the same thing with startups. And in some ways they just, you know, they don't treat themselves as startups, but they do everything a startup does.
Yeah. There's definitely, so I'm kind of leaning towards like this bootstrapper movement where, you know, just you have an entrepreneur or a very small team of people who are like self-funding their idea, you know? So they usually sort of these micro like SaaS products are usually where you see that. And they have the same, you know, all of those conversations, like, you know, how to use A/B testing, how to validate your idea, like how to not waste money on building an idea no one wants. Like it's all, you know, it's the same stuff you would see in like a funded startup talk. It's just this, you know, the scales are different. Some of the techniques are different because if you're funded, then you can just throw money. You know, you have a lot more money to spend to try out ideas.
Yeah.
Whereas bootstrappers have to be a little bit more, you know, cautious.
Yeah, totally. I think that's one of the things I still like about Kitty in some ways is that when we take on like a side project for fun, we still apply a certain amount of constraints under it. And, you know, I'm always saying, you know, let's do something fun for, you know, 30 days or whatever, 60 days. And of course, I'm thinking that's enough time. And then, you know, before I know it, you know, Chishara, the developer, pulled off on a weekend. And I'm like, damn it, guys, it was just 60 days. And they're like, hey, get it done. I'm like, okay, but come on, man. My metrics are off, you know. But, of course, that's the whole thing with a lot of stuff with Kitty is it's everything's iteration. You know, the first iteration is this piece of Frankenware that can barely get up off the floor and looks really shitty. And but then it gets better.
Yeah. So do you think it's necessary even if you build something like, so I always try to, I guess what I struggle with sometimes is just how much do you build out, you know?
Yep.
Do you even have to build anything at all when you start? You know, and so, I mean, what are the techniques to kind of, if you're, you know, have limited time, and you sort of have an idea for a project, but you may not necessarily know even exactly what to build yet. I mean, so what are the sort of basic things that you can, that you typically try to just sort of validate your idea or validate maybe even the need?
Well, so I guess one, I think for me, it all starts with where you can get data from. So when you have the idea, where can you get some data from? And if the data is in a couple different people that you can talk to, you know, come up with a set of questions, you know, 10 questions, make sure you're asking the same 10 questions as, you know, the same, you know, multiple people, so you have data that you can compare. That's key. A lot of times if you, you know, you ask, you know, 10 different questions to 10 different people, you, yeah, you got a bunch of data, but none of it's comparable, so you're kind of like, you kind of wasted that effort. So, you know, make it consistent on that. Sometimes it's okay if it's just you. So this is one probably thing that is hard for a lot of people to get, I guess, is that it's okay to build in a vacuum without users. Just be realistic that it's, it, you're building for yourself at the moment. And that piece that you may end up building for yourself is not so much the product. It's just you're trying to build a better communication tool that didn't have a conversation with somebody about it. So there's a lot of stuff in BigKitty where, like right now, we're not ready to go have this conversation with these people because they're going to basically get stuck on trying to understand it because we don't have the right thing to communicate. So let's go build the thing that looks like a tricycle, but it's really, you know, like two pedals and the whole thing falls apart, right?
Right.
But let's just make it look like it. So they go like, oh, yeah, I mean, it's like a bike. You're like, yeah, sweet. You know, it's like that's part of the problem, I think, when you talk to people is if you don't give them enough stuff for them to review and look at and have a conversation on, you end up sort of wasting that conversation.
Yeah.
So a lot of ways for me, that's where I go, I do wireframes, you know, I sketch everything and sometimes I'll sketch it all on paper and then I'll use something like that Pop-In app where I can shoot all the screens and put them on the phone. And then I try to sketch together the whole freaking app as much as I can. And then I sit down and walk through it with somebody. And sometimes I'm walking through it with principal stakeholders. Like these are people who would normally buy. And sometimes it's people who are just like, you know, I'm just looking for general sort of UX feeling tips, you know, like what do they generally sense?
Okay.
And then I haven't gone to code yet. The other thing I do along the same time is I'll go and I'll explore the API databases out there because I always try to leverage most of my own ideas tend to be some derivative of a natural flow of where data is going to come from, like a Twitter or a social network or a stock market or browsing behavior or something. Like I want something that's going to have this inherent flow of data coming in and we'll process that. It's really hard for me to take on an idea where it's a complete chicken and egg thing where, you know, if users give us all the data on the planet, then this thing works great. Those ideas, I tend to go away from because I'm like, I'm trying to take on Mission Impossible and I'm just like, I don't think it's ready yet.
Right. It's like when those ideas hit, it's like, well, you're missing the hardest part, which is getting the users to give you all their data.
In fact, I've had some of those ideas in the past where I almost split the idea into two ideas. Like the first idea is how to pre-populate this world so it feels like it's real. So that's like a whole quest in itself. And then there's the product itself. So it's like, you know, like, if I, you know, could I use Mechanical Turk to generate 98% of this world so it looks like it's real so that when a new user comes in, it actually feels real and then they buy into that world and then use the world and then they, you know what I mean?
Does that kind of excite you when you're thinking about an idea and it just, all these possibilities start to unlock, or does that sort of demotivate you?
No, I get excited as long as I divide and conquer them. Like I had to put them up on the wall. So I have like a project wall in my house where I have like just a ton of notes on this wall. My wife thinks I'm like a weird like serial killer. Like I got all these things. You know? Like what are you doing? But it's like and then I have to like lock myself in and like, okay, this week we're doing environments and I'm going to list, you know, 20 environments. So I'm going to try to detail them. And I always try to use Mechanical Turk. Like I'm trying to get Mechanical Turk to source me, you know, weapons and armor types and like, go on,
oh, man.
You know, And I challenged them. I'm like, go online, find me, 50 different types of axes. And they're like, oh, you can have this axe and this axe. And like, do this, Excel table for me. And they're like, okay, sure. And of course they have fun. They have no idea that they're contributing to this massively crazy game, but, it's like, if I could divide and conquer, that's cool. Yeah. I don't know. It's a weird thing. And it's funny is that, I do like it when the idea, what's the most thrilling part of Big Kitty is the first 2 weeks. So it's when I hand off my initial, like, this is my batshit crazy idea, Tishar, help me out. then literally within the first week, something comes back and it's like magic.
Yeah.
It's like, it's coded and it runs. And people, you have the 100% of the vision in your head, and then people, when they work on it, they're working on like what they see is 30% of it, right? Because they don't really know you, they don't really get what you're trying to do. But and then so you see some things that work and some things that don't. Sometimes they do brand new things that are like, wow, that's a much better mechanic than I thought it would be, And it's really that being enabled for me is like the most amazing thing ever. And so I didn't have that until I really got into Kitty. I had a ton of ideas. And it was hard to get enabled.
Right. But now you're really well practiced at enabling those ideas. And
right.
I think that's pretty interesting because, I started to hire, some people out for projects, and I have an intern. Hi, Andrew. He's working on a podcast app for me right now for Flyover.
Awesome.
It's really cool. We're gonna roll that out in the next month or so. But he'll come up, I'll give him a task, and he did this task for just a client about recommending their sites, and just without even me prompting, he added this really awesome animation that kicks off when you click the go button and do the action. And I was just gobsmacked. I was like, that's amazing. That looks great. And I didn't even ask for it. And, I was like, oh, okay. So if I give up control more,
that's really the secret to development.
Yeah.
Is giving up control.
And you just have the opportunity for other people to really surprise you and delight you.
Yeah. I think that's something that I've always, preached, and it was really hard. It's really hard for corporations to get that.
Yeah.
It's also hard for Ohio State to get. Ohio State still has there's a lot of old school, even folks like Tech Columbus on that. There's a lot of this notion of like, wait, if you give up control, people are going to screw up and fail. And I'm like, yes, it's going to be beautiful. Let's go check it out together.
Penicillin was a failure.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't planning on making.
Yeah, I know. It's like, let's go for that. I think because there's I think the magic is when people can kind of come together and you see, like, just like that guy is doing, he's adding this piece to it. Or like when, Tishara surprises me with, hey, we built this brand new hack over the weekend. And, or I give somebody a general line of information and they pull it off. I think the only thing and the opposite factor, there's sometimes I do find myself sometimes reaching back into a project and saying, no, make the connections here. Like,
yeah,
here's the green wire. This is what I want you to tie into, But I think that you have to – to me, it comes down to sort of the expectations and how you kind of run and what's the vibe you're sort of setting when you're working with people is, And I tell people it's never about setting the bar super high. To me, the bar is like on the freaking floor, and we like high five each other that we woke up this morning, and then we high five again when we we said hello, and then we just always sort of celebrating every moment and just keeping that momentum going, and not it's not about aspiring to do bad work. It's just it's about, man, this whole space is so awesomely passionate or like totally destroying. And it's like, you can either get to pick which side of the ball you want to be on. You can totally judge yourself and saying that you're a failure all your life, or you can celebrate the fact that you made something. So,
yeah. Well, with that, I think I'm going to, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. Dan, is there anything you'd like to plug? Anything you'd like to tell the audience about before you go?
No, I'd say be sure to get to Startup Weekend sometime soon and experience something, build something. And let's try to give back to folks in need this holiday season.
Awesome. Dan, thanks very much, man, for being on the podcast. Really enjoyed it.
Sweet. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Flyover Startups Podcast. If you or someone you know is an entrepreneur in a flyover state, let us know at contact@flyover.fm or on Twitter @flyoverfm. For more episodes, you can listen to us at our website, flyover.fm, or subscribe to us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.